This is Kimberly Atkinstor, senior opinion writer and columnist for the Boston Globe and co-host for the podcast Hashtag Sisters-in-Law. And welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. Well, President Biden announced this week that the United States would ban the imports of Russian oil and gas, a move that's been met with mostly approval, despite promises of spiking gas prices and general inflation. So let's bring in our left, right, and center panel to discuss this move. I'm your guest host and your center, and I'm joined by Sarah Isger, staff writer at The Dispatch. On the right, she was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. And on the left, we have David Dayan. He is the executive editor at The American Prospect. Hello, Sarah and David.
Hello.
Hello.
So let's talk about this move to ban the import of Russian oil. I will start with you, Sarah. Was this move expected, and do you think it's the right one?
So for the United States, it doesn't affect us as much as Europe. That's why we end up going alone at this. Only 3% of our crude oil comes from Russia as opposed to 27% of Europe's. So there's a few problems that comes with that. One, there's some unintended consequences. For instance, Russia's oil prices actually are going up slightly because we've withdrawn as a purchaser. So that's not great, right? We don't want to help Russia. But at the same time, I think Americans are pretty united that anything we can do to hurt Russia, to not buy Russia, that's a good thing. And you're certainly seeing that in the private sector. McDonald's saying that they're not opening their restaurants there. Big law firms cutting clients and or shuttering their Moscow offices. I think the problem for the Biden administration, though, is going to be, can they keep focus on the fact that gas prices are rising because of Putin, when in fact, gas prices in the United States were rising well in advance of the conflict in Ukraine? And I think you're going to see Republicans try very hard to make that an issue in the fall. And the question is whether it'll be successful when inflation overall is going up so much. Gas prices not only affect your price at the pump, but they affect the price of your groceries, your kids' toys, and everything else in between.
And I want to get more to the political impact of this in just a moment. But David, first, this economic issue, we've heard the president speaking again and again to the American people, including during the State of the Union, saying that this is going to be tough, that this is going to be a sacrifice, but this is something that we must do in the interest of protecting democracy abroad. Do you think that that is a message that the president is going to be able to continue?
I don't think the Biden administration wanted to initially do this. His hand was forced by a bipartisan group in Congress. It should be noted that the day after this Russian energy ban was announced, oil prices dropped 12%. And that happened for two reasons. Number one, oil was already effectively banned from Russia because traders wouldn't trade it, shippers wouldn't ship it, and oil companies were pulling out of the country. So there was nothing really to ban. This was a classic case of buying the rumor and selling on the news. Once it actually happened, there wasn't any reason to continue to run up the price because the damage was done. The second reason that oil prices dropped by 12% on Wednesday, and as of we're taping this on Thursday, and things are holding flat today, is the talk of a potential ceasefire. Now, I don't know how realistic that is, but certainly it animated traders to drop the price of oil. And what it shows is that diplomacy is the only real answer if you're going to get gas prices and oil prices down the way from the level they had spiked to prior to the war. The run-up is significant since the war began. And the only way to counteract that is by ending the war. And we can certainly talk about the ways in which Republicans are talking about this as if there's a spigot in the White House that you can turn on and say, hey, more oil now. The truth is that Wall Street traders and oil CEOs really like the fact that oil prices are high. They lost a lot of money on fracking in the past decade when there was overinvestment, and they have very decidedly, oil investors have said, don't drill more oil. There was a fantastic and amazing headline in the Financial Times this week, and the headline was, "Oil Industry Pleads with Wall Street to Stop Holding Back Investment." That's what's going on in the market today. And this continued insistence that Joe Biden somehow do something to counteract that is interesting to me. There are some levers that that can be pulled. I don't think anyone's going to actually like them. One is nationalizing these oil companies. So if you really want them to drill more for oil, you can you have the wherewithal to do that, as we see with state-owned oil companies across the country or across the world. The other one is to put a windfall profit tax, which we had in the 1970s, which we had after World War II, which would say to the industry that you're not going to be able to suppress the supply and make profit on that. You're going to have to, if you want to make more money, you're going to have to drill more. So those are the options essentially available from a policy standpoint. I don't know how likely they are that a Congress would pass them on a bipartisan basis, but that's the reality as long as Wall Street is holding the whip hand.
So I want to turn to the issue of public opinion and the politics of this. Quinnipiac poll found that 71% of respondents supported the ban on Russian oil, and that includes 66% of Republicans and 82% of Democrats. You know, one thing that I think that has been extraordinary since the beginning of Russia's aggression in Ukraine is the unity, not just the unity among folks on Capitol Hill and the bipartisan unity in calling out, but for the most part, with a few exceptions, in calling out Russia and standing firm with NATO allies, but also of the American people. It seems the American people understand that this is important, understand that this is wrong, and is unified in a way that, given the politics have been, the way politics have been over the past 2 years, actually really surprised me. Sarah, do you think that this sort of unity is sustaining? And is it dangerous for Republicans if they choose this moment to start bashing President Biden over gas prices?
So it's a fascinating divide within the Republican Party. And as you've said, some of that unity is actually, I think, strengthening the hand of the, I don't want to call them anti-Trump forces within the Republican Party, but the more Trump skeptical forces within the party, because it has marginalized, I think, the pro-Putin, pro-Russia folks within the Republican Party who have tended to be very, very MAGA Trump voices. And so that's been a really interesting just intra-political effect of some of that unity that you're speaking of. In terms of 2022 and the midterm elections, right, Republicans have had the wind at their backs for the last year, expected to take back the House, where they only need to win five seats. And the Senate split 50-50, so they just need a net gain of one. And this has certainly changed, I think, some of the calculus of the messaging, right? The messaging as of a month ago, let's say, was the Biden administration has failed at everything, and crime and your kids at school, and you need more control over that. And so that inflation message around the Biden administration becomes a little bit trickier, because as we were talking about just before in the gas segment, the gas price conversation is complicated. Now, you already see Republicans trying to argue that Joe Biden is against energy independence. He's not doing the things that you would want to see him do if you wanted to produce more energy here at home. There is some truth to that. The problem is that a lot of what the Biden administration has tried to do to prevent some of that energy production at home either hasn't been successful or hasn't actually mattered in terms of being energy independent today, for instance. So the permitting and land leasing for new drilling, well, that was blocked by a judge in Louisiana. So it's true that the Biden administration didn't want that to happen, but it's also true that there's more permits out of the Biden administration at this point than there were under the Trump administration. So all of those arguments get a little more complicated and a little more nuanced. And of course, even if we were producing more energy at home, and I'm from Texas, so this is like I'm from Houston. I mean, like, this is how my city booms and busts. it gets even more complicated because the refinery productions that we have are really for that heavy crude. I've heard other journalists try to compare it to like coffee grounds. You've got to get the coffee grounds out of the coffee. Well, the energy that we produce mostly here in the United States is lighter crude, more like champagne or already ground coffee. And so finer ground. And so we don't have the refinery capabilities for some of that here. So again, if we're talking about energy independence long-term, I think there are very good criticisms of the Biden administration. But if you're talking about why, you know, how we could get energy independent tomorrow, that's a hard case for the Republicans to make. That being said, prices were going up before the Ukrainian crisis, and I think Republicans will try to stick to that message while perhaps dancing a little bit more delicately around the rally around the flag aspects around Joe Biden. But again, November's a long way off, and we have yet to see whether Biden can maintain that bump that he's gotten in his approval numbers in just the last week. Whether that could really hold for 6 months is unlikely.
Yeah, David, speaking of that little bump that he has gotten, I think we know that some things, as Sarah pointed out, are still true. Going into the midterms, Republicans still have the winds at their back indeed. And one thing that this crisis has done is really scrambled the Democrats' agenda. They're no longer talking about the domestic policies that were at the core of that agenda, or at least those messages are not getting through in the same way. Despite this short-term bump, is this a long-term political problem for Democrats?
I mean, I think they should be talking about those agenda items, and particularly the need to transition away to gain true energy independence as a national security imperative, which is moving to a green transition. I mean, what this crisis has shown is that you can drill as much oil as you want stateside, but oil is in a global market, and if you cut off a significant amount of supply globally, that's going to have an upward effect on prices. And for all of this idea that we've you know, put together this incredible amount of energy capacity within the United States, the fact that Wall Street investors are suppressing the supply shows that none of that really meant much of anything, because ultimately those investors are in it for money and they like high prices. So it's difficult for me to see how in the long term this ends with anything other than moving towards a green transition. Now it's become very hard to do that right now, because in addition to oil going up, we've seen spiking commodities for much the same reason that Russia produces a significant amount of certain commodities. The price of nickel went to an all-time high on Monday and then doubled on Tuesday because there's a substantial nickel supply within Russia. What is nickel a main ingredient in? Electric car batteries. So you're just not going to be able. Unfortunately, we wasted the moment when these things were cheap and plentiful, and now we're in a position where we're trying to do a green transition with very expensive commodities. Last thought is, if I know anything about Americans, is I know they have short-term memories, and I imagine the ones who say that they're willing to suffer the consequences of an oil-induced recession, which every time oil prices have spiked historically, it has brought a recession. I imagine those people saying they're willing to sacrifice, they'll be the same ones pointing the finger at politicians when that recession shows up.
And David, I just want to sort of get back to this issue of the Democrats' agenda in just the couple minutes before a break. You know, people were talking about the issues that are within things like Build Back Better, and we're not talking about that. Isn't that damaging to Democrats and to President Biden when voters go back to the polls? That's still going to be front of mind for them.
It's absolutely damaging to not forward an agenda. Now, Joe Manchin earlier, I believe last week, talked about a possibility of a version that is really focused on energy, and then uses whatever revenues from tax reform, half of it would go to deficit reduction, half of it would go to energy. I think there's a renewed interest in doing something with respect to clean energy tax credits. I believe Manchin wants to do sort of an all of the above energy boost to increase production and abundance at home. You know, I think the Ukraine crisis shows that the lack of resiliency that we have within our economy, within our commerce, the inability to have the capacity to weather crises on our own points to the need for a serious change in the way that our economy works, and particularly around energy. So I do think there's a possibility that we renew this conversation. But if it doesn't, and we miss this opportunity, then I do think that there will be a price paid at the polls.
Okay, I'll be right back with Sarah Isger, staff writer at The Dispatch, and David Dayan, executive editor at The American Prospect. And we will talk more about the Russian oil ban and what it means for climate change. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
This is Left, Right, and Center. We're changing things up, but always keeping it civilized yet provocative. Let us know what you want to hear or who you want to hear from. You can ask a question or leave a comment at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, columnist for the Boston Globe. And on the right, we have Sarah Isger of The Dispatch. And on the left, we have David Dayan at The American Prospect. And we are joined now by our special guest, Sammy Roth. He covers energy for the Los Angeles Times and writes their weekly Boiling Point newsletter. Hi, Sammy.
Hey, Kimberly.
So one thing that I have noticed in all of this discussion and looking at the reaction from President Biden is, on the one hand, he is talking about Americans sacrificing, and we may be able to see, we're going to feel it at the pump for a while. But he's not also naturally, in a way that I expected him to, sort of parlaying that conversation to talk about changing, focusing on clean energy the way David's been talking about. What does that say to you about the future of clean energy and what this moment means?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that Biden has discussed this somewhat. I mean, when he came out at the White House and made this speech about banning Russian coal, oil, and gas imports, he did make some comments about how the long-term solution here in his mind is to transition more quickly off of fossil fuels, do a big investment in electric vehicles, weatherize homes, energy efficiency, switch to electric sources of heating. He discussed that. It definitely hasn't been a big focus, though. I mean, his State of the Union, despite all of the time and effort they've spent trying to get climate measures passed and build back better, he hardly discussed that at all in the State of the Union. So, you know, it's to be seen how much effort they're really going to put into this. I mean, if I had to guess, it's politics. They're concerned about, you know, how people would react if they spent a lot of time talking about this right now. But the goals are still there.
So let's take a step back for a moment and look at the broader scope of this. How big of a deal is it to reject Russian oil and natural gas at this moment? How reliant are Americans on it?
Not especially. A very small percentage of oil in the United States comes from Russia. I mean, the U.S. is now the world's biggest oil producer. We're a major exporter as well. We still import from other countries, but very little from Russia. Interestingly, one of the places actually that Russian fuel comes to the most in the United States is refineries on the West Coast in California and Washington State in particular. But even here, it's still a relatively small percentage. Europe, it's a much bigger deal. I mean, in Europe, they get like 25% of their oil and something like 40% of their natural gas from Russia. So there's a reason that you see the U.S. being able to take this step when it's much more difficult for Europe to do that.
And talking about if the United States was to take this moment and try to make a push away from fossil fuels toward greener energy, how easy would that be? Keeping in mind, on the one hand, as we talked about, the sort of fossil fuels we can tap here in the United States would come from fracking. It's not like it would be online tomorrow. It would take months to a year to get to that energy. We certainly don't have a green energy infrastructure stood up in a way that's ready to go either. Which way might this go?
Well, I mean, first I would say nothing on climate is going to be easy at this point in 2022. I mean, this is a problem that we've seen coming for decades and have done, you know, relatively little from a policy standpoint to take this seriously. So we're sort of, you know, behind the eight ball on it. That said, I mean, I think the building blocks are there. I mean, the solar and wind industries and lithium ion batteries as well have started to grow really rapidly in the United States. You know, for solar and wind especially, costs have come down so much that those are now among the very cheapest sources of electricity. And in fact, and in a lot of parts of the country, it's cheaper to build new solar and wind power to run the power grid than it is to continue operating existing fossil fueled plants. So those industries are in, you know, pretty good shape to expand pretty fast if the support was there federally and, you know, state by state. You know, I've been talking with energy and climate experts about this, and they of course point to the Build Back Better legislation that's been stalled in the Senate. There are $555 billion that would be in there for climate and clean energy. A lot of that would go to electric vehicles, building out electric vehicle chargers, making homes more efficient, installing electric heat pumps to replace gas boilers for heating. You know, those are steps that could really put the United States, if that were passed, on the path to, phasing out fossil fuels more quickly. And I mean, it's also worth keeping in mind that, you know, this is obviously a global issue. So to the extent that the United States invests in this stuff, there's potential to export those technologies to Europe and help them get off of fossil fuels. And the European Union right now is doing the same. Just this week, the European Union, they put out a plan for how they're going to cut dependence on Russian fossil fuels. 40% by 2030 is their goal. They want to get 10 million heat pumps into homes over the next 8 years. They want to invest in green hydrogen to burn that instead of oil and gas. So the pieces are out there. Whether or not the political will is going to come together, I think, as usual, is the question with climate.
So, Sarah, what is it going to take to get us all in our electric cars without fear that we're going to get stuck on 95 in a traffic jam and run out of electricity? I know for Republicans, certainly, they're quick to push back on things like the Green New Deal. But what about the issue of conservation? Can we even get consensus at the fact that, hey, we should probably be using less energy? We should push conservation. Is there any middle ground there between Republicans and Democrats on the issue of energy here?
So I think there's two important points to make about this. One, a lot of the Republican pushback about things like the Green New Deal are that what the United States does will have little to no impact on global temperatures if China and India are partially on board, at least as well. These rising economies, of course, arguing that it's very unfair to punish them for trying to expand their economy now, something the United States did 100 years ago. And so the United States should then have to make the sacrifice now while they produce lots and lots more carbon-based pollution. And the United States are arguing, why are we unilaterally hurting our own economy? So that's the first Republican pushback, is that when you're talking about global temperatures, what the United States does alone simply is not going to make a big enough dent, if a dent at all. But second, the argument is the private sector is far better at this. Government subsidizing certain industries just hasn't been that successful. And obviously they point to things like Solyndra during the Obama administration that were sort of this debacle of, you know, millions, billions of dollars wasted. And that if you let the private sector figure out which energy is actually going to work, be cheaper, and move the ball forward, that will be far more beneficial than banning certain types of light bulbs or putting a thumb on the scale in terms of which electric engine, battery can really move forward. And so it's not, I don't think, that Republicans don't believe in climate change, don't want a clean environment, things like that. It's that the Biden administration, the progressive way of doing it, they think will actually be counterproductive. And they would point to something like nuclear energy. You know, if you really believed in green energy, if you really wanted to simply get off carbon-based fuels, then you should be far more in favor of nuclear energy, which the left is not. And so that's where I think, you know, is there room for bipartisanship? Yes. But I think that they're talking on two different planes, basically, and the two sides really aren't engaging in a conversation that could reach bipartisan consensus because they're talking about different stuff.
David, I want to go to you. There's a lot of impediments to this agreement, everything from the former president once again talking about windmills and birds to folks like Joe Manchin, who are really controlling the conversation about climate on Capitol Hill. Do you think that there is any room to get to greener policy here?
Well, there certainly should be, because it's staring us in the face. I mean, it's amusing to hear about how the private sector can handle this better when the private sector is failing in real time as we speak. The private sector is constricting supply of energy while prices strike so investors can get big dividends. It's not working. And I will also note that the investment that was made by the government in Solyndra was also that same investment was made in Tesla, which is the number one biggest company by market value, at least in the automotive sector in the world. I'm certainly fine with nuclear, by the way, but it's very costly to build a factory. We haven't seen one built in this country in decades. This is going to be extremely tough because I do agree with Sarah that there are two different conversations going on. And there are actually more than two. I mean, the conversation that Joe Manchin had the conversation that Joe Manchin is having is not the same conversation that many Democrats are having around this. But I think you just have to sort of look at what's happening right now and look at how this and not just with us, but particularly with Europe, which made this very unwise bet that they thought they would get reliable energy sources out of Russia, just how this entire market for energy has warped our ability to engage in geopolitics. It's warped our ability to preserve national security. It's really, really damaging. And it's made us, you know, it's paralyzed us in many ways. To what's happening right now. So I think that the administration has two good arguments. One is the national security argument, and the other is the jobs argument. They can certainly say that it would not hurt our economy to become the recognized leader in the production of heat pumps and provide them to Europe so that they can get off of the dependence on Russian natural gas and thereby bolster our economy in innumerable ways by increasing our manufacturing base. So that's the argument that I think Biden is most comfortable with, making a jobs argument about climate. We'll have to see if, you know, Manchin's sort of rumbling about a forthcoming deal will actually happen. But we desperately need the $500 billion that was in the Build Back Better Act initially, in clean energy investments and incentives.
Sammy, you wrote last week that Ukraine is a climate story because everything is a climate story. Now, that was before the announcement about the Russian oil ban. But tell us what you meant by that. How is Ukraine a climate story?
Well, I mean, it's a climate story in the sense that one of the reasons why it's so hard to push back against Russia and to take, you know, dramatic steps to combat Russian influence is because it is a petrostate, because of the enormous amounts of oil and gas that are extracted in Russia that are used largely in Europe, but also in other parts of the world. That's one of the reasons why there's so much caution about dealing with Russia. I mean, the nuclear deterrent is another thing, but so much of Russia's power and its ability to fund its economy and its military comes from oil and gas. So we're sitting here having this conversation about, you know, how do you get off of those fuels or how do you limit Russian influence? And of course, it's a climate conversation because burning oil and gas and coal is at the heart of what's got us to the situation we're in. One other thing I want to bring up here, I mean, Sarah and David were just discussing costs and jobs and different types of investments. I've done a lot of reporting on this and there's all sorts of research looking at what would be the economic impacts of making this, you know, this really dramatic switch from a fossil fuel-based economy to one that's largely electrified and powered by solar and wind primarily. All of the research I've seen on this shows that if you make that transition, you're going to drive down energy costs in the long term and really reduce the amounts that Americans are paying for energy just because the fuel is so much cheaper. The sun, the wind, they're cheap. They're obviously all sorts of investments that are needed to support that and upfront costs. But if you take the long-term view and think, what are people actually paying for energy over the long run? It's a lot less if you make that transition because you're not vulnerable to what's happening with oil and gas prices.
But that's a tough argument to make still. I mean, it's always been tough. That's why we are where we are right now, right, Sammy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, America overall is not all that good at taking the long view. We get, really caught up in short-term costs and benefits and incentives, and politicians are looking at, you know, what are people going to say in the next election? It's it's one of the reasons that climate has been so tough. But when we do it, it has tended to work out on this issue. I mean, Sarah and David were discussing Solyndra, and David brought up Tesla. I've reported on that loan guarantee program, and actually that program overall made the federal government money because most of the companies it invested in succeeded and paid back their loans with interest. Solyndra was one of the very few that didn't work out. So there's precedent. I mean, the U.S. large-scale solar industry, if you live out here in California and you drive through the desert and you see big solar farms, these are starting to crop up all over the country now. And that's in, you know, at least in part because of the investments that were made in that program to help launch this industry.
All right. That was Sammy Roth, energy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And I've been talking with Sarah Isger of The Dispatch and David Dayan at The American Prospect. We'll be right back with a bill in Florida known as Don't Say Gay. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
New year, new show. We're making changes to Left, Right, and Center, and you can weigh in. Leave a comment or ask us a question at kcrw.com/LRC.
We are back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Kimberly Atkins-Store, columnist for the Boston Globe. And on the right is Sarah Isger of The Dispatch and former spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. And on the left is David Dayan, executive editor at The American Prospect. Well, this week, Florida passed a couple of bills that we are going to discuss. The first bans instruction about sexual orientation or gender identity in grades kindergarten through third grade. It is the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, and it had already passed the State House, and Governor Ron DeSantis has said he will sign the legislation. Also this week, the Florida legislature passed a measure prohibiting training that could cause someone to feel guilty or ashamed about their past collective action based on their race or sex. That is called the Stop Woke Act. So let's start with these bills. Sarah, what is your take on them?
All right. So I think looking at these bills, by themselves, you miss why these bills happen, right? Historians are not just going to look at this one Florida piece of legislation and say that it came out of nowhere. That being said, there are certainly things about the Florida legislation, both of them, frankly, that I think will be challenged in court and I think are likely to lose because they're overbroad. So for instance, the word instruction isn't defined. It's only a 7-page bill. It's relatively short on the quote-unquote Don't Say Gay bill. It also doesn't define what's age appropriate. And so if a teacher doesn't have fair notice as to what a law is supposed to prohibit, that law is overbroad and is likely to be struck down by a court. Similarly, on the anti-woke bill, same idea. If what's prohibited is how you make someone else feel with your words, that's going to be very hard in terms of putting someone on notice of what they can and cannot do, likely to be struck down by a court.
Right. And the legislation says it bans the lessons that, quote, may not occur in kindergarten through grade 3 or in a manner that is not age appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students in accordance with state standards. That means nothing. That legislation literally means nothing. And I take that point. But what this is, what both of these bills and other bills, including those targeting critical race theory, seem to be, is evidence of Republicans' unending appetite for stoking culture wars. And they think that that works well for them. And they saw how well, it seems, the culture wars worked around things like mask mandates in schools. You can look at the Virginia gubernatorial election, and that seems to be a playbook here. But one thing that concerns me about this is you're talking about children at this point. You're talking about children and laws that affect how they may see themselves in their own lesson plans. Why does this is very different from, in my opinion, things that affect only adults, even though those things are, I think they're disingenuous as well. Why do you think there's this push forward on this?
So let me push back on one thing you said, which is from the conservative perspective, you've had liberals and progressives try to inculcate a certain view of America or gender identity or sexual orientation into these curriculums. And so then when conservatives push back, all of a sudden the media says, well, they're the ones starting this culture war. And conservatives are like, well, no, they started it. It's just when we push back that it's a culture war. And so, you know, not a lot of Americans actually think you should be instructing students on gender identity in kindergarten through third grade. That's something that their parents can talk about with them, but not really something that you want a first grade teacher instructing, quote unquote, a student on. But I think there's also a larger conversation here, and it's both about schools and not, right? It's this idea of parental control in schools and who determines you know, what your kids are learning. And it really did start because of COVID to some extent, as public schools came under the microscope. You know, these public schools are closed, and in San Francisco, the school board is worried about renaming a school that's named after Abraham Lincoln instead of reopening the school. And it brings up this school choice fight that Republicans have been having for decades now, arguing that your school shouldn't be based on your zip code. You should be able to pick which school your kid goes to. And I think that's some of what's coming to the fore here. But you also have, you know, even bring in now the social media fights. You have the left pressuring social media companies to take down certain content, which it's a private company, right? Twitter's allowed to ban Donald Trump if they want to. But then you have the right saying, well, if you're going to use your power to pressure companies to do that, then we're going to use our power at the state legislative level to use law to ban companies from doing that. And so you see this escalation on both sides, the result of which is actually a very illiberal tolerance for free speech at all. And as both sides keep escalating that war, what loses is speech. What loses is a debate as a country about any issues, because either speech is prohibited by law, or it's simply disfavored and culturally censored. In either way, I think if you are sort of a traditional classical liberal, if you will, there should be a lot more voices out there speaking up for free speech. But unfortunately, both sides see it as the only way to get back at the other side, to win over their efforts. We won't unilaterally disarm because they're against free speech, so we have to be against their speech. And again, the big loser here, I think, unfortunately, is all of the rest of us who want to be able to talk about things and think that free speech is how you get the best ideas forward.
David, what do you think? Do you think this is a free speech issue?
Well, I do appreciate that Sarah acknowledges that to some degree, this is about an ideological effort around school vouchers. I do think that's certainly part of this. What I think is this is a longstanding effort. I mean, we've seen in California, the Briggs Initiative in the 1970s to ban gay teachers. We saw Anita Bryant's crusades also in Florida in the 1970s. There has been this desire to use to political advantage these kinds of tactics to instill fear in parents over what is happening in classrooms. And we've seen it be effective over and over again, and that's why conservatives go back to it. But I do think that there is more recent history that shows the potential for overreach. I mean, the thing I've been thinking about with respect to this all week is the famous bathroom law in North Carolina in the 2010s. And what that ended up doing was made North Carolina something of a pariah within the corporate world in terms of events not being held in North Carolina, which is their speech right as much as it is North Carolina legislators' speech right to say that bathrooms need to be for male or female only or whatever was in that law. We saw so much pressure put on North Carolina that that legislature repealed that ban. And I think there is likely to be a lot of pressure to bear. Now, very interestingly, Disney, which is a major player in the Florida legislature, was pretty quiet throughout this legislative effort until there was a little bit more of a public perception and public outcry. And now the head of Disney is saying they're against the bill and they're going to go talk to Governor DeSantis. I think that's probably just the beginning. And if Ron DeSantis wants to know how difficult this could get for him, he should go talk to his counterpart in North Carolina, a guy named Pat McCrory, who actually lost re-election in large part because of the controversy over the transgender bathroom bill.
Well, David, there may be that pushback, but according to Freedom for All Americans, which advocates for LGBTQ non-discrimination protections, state lawmakers have filed more than 170 anti-LGBTQ bills so far this year, which surpasses the total number of last year. It's only March. And they say at least 69 of them are centered on school policies. And I also want to talk about this is one of what I call the vigilante laws, right? Because this law would also give parents the right to sue teachers who put what they deem as something inappropriate in the lesson plans. And this builds on the abortion law in Texas. There is a Texas bill that could also cause people in a vigilante way to accuse their neighbors of child abuse if they have trans children. In Oklahoma, we see this happening for parents can sue if they don't teach certain religious practices or teach lessons that go against their religious practices. And it's happening on the left, too. A Democratic bill in California would seek to give the right to sue anyone involved in the gun manufacturing process in the event of a gun death or injury. Talk about this vigilante nature of it. That seems to scream stoking of culture wars by turning neighbor on neighbor.
It's a really tragic development. Texas opened a Pandora's box here, and the Supreme Court, by essentially blessing it, allowing it to go through, spurred, you know, it created this other safety valve that if you want to get something done that the Supreme Court might not agree with, well, then you can go around it by using this tactic, which effectively nullifies any kind of judicial review. I think California is doing that, attempting to do this with respect to guns in direct reaction to that. It's a messaging bill to show that these are the consequences of creating a vigilante society. And I don't know how you call a ceasefire in this war, but it is very, very dangerous.
Sarah, what do you think?
I totally agree that the Texas SB 8 legislation is what started this, right? It was this creative idea where if you don't have someone individual to sue, like a governor or an attorney general, then it leaves the federal courts in kind of a messy position. And the Supreme Court agreed. It said, look, if there's no one to enjoin, we can only then enforce the law after it's in place. So the bad news is enjoining this law, preventing the law from going into effect, these vigilante laws, as you're calling them, which I think is a fair enough name, frankly. Not much to do about that, it turns out. But it doesn't mean that the Supreme Court or any lower court can't find these laws unconstitutional when you do, in fact, go sue your neighbor. And that's happening in Texas right now. It's going to happen in California if that happens. Similar laws moving in Missouri. And you pointed out all these sorts of these laws where people think they have somehow figured out an end run around judicial review. They haven't. All they've done is allowed the laws to go into effect and then get found unconstitutional for infringing on someone's rights. So overall, I'm not that concerned long-term. What I'm more about the laws themselves, what I'm very concerned about though, is the reason that people are pursuing these laws, which I think David and I, it sounds like, largely agree on. This idea that we don't want to live in a pluralistic society where people can disagree on how to raise their kids or whether to own guns or even whether to seek an abortion, that it's okay for different states to have different laws, that it's okay for different schools to have different curriculums. This is sort of what America was based on. And again, I guess it goes back to my free speech point a little. It is, in fact, our duty as Americans to defend someone's right to say something odious, to say something you strongly disagree with. Banning it by, you know, pressuring corporations to pull out of certain states or not do business or get someone fired from their job because you don't like their speech, or on the flip side, passing a law that they're not allowed to say that, is so deeply un-American to me. And these vigilante laws are simply part and parcel of that larger cultural trend against pluralism, against classical liberalism, that I think that's the dangerous part to me, is that people think this is an appropriate response to speech they don't like or politics they don't like.
Sarah, is there any concern on this when you look at the big picture? If we look at the change in public attitudes over things like same-sex marriage over time, and you see people who are staunchly opposed to that, and in retrospect, history does not look at that opposition so kindly, I think there is going to be a different trajectory here when it comes to transgender Americans. But is there a fear that Republicans here are going to look in the long run on the wrong side of history?
I don't know the answer to that, although I think about that historical lens so often, especially in regard to, you know, Trump, for instance, this idea that Trump created these voters versus these voters created Trump. I think that largely what we're seeing in our political moment right now is actually a result of the 2008 financial crisis that was worldwide. And yet we focus so much on like, well, that's how you get Trump, and, you know, in these domestic squabbles. And I think there's much larger trends happening. And to your point about the problems for the Republican Party, you know, the left has predicted Republicans being on the wrong side of history before. It's part of why the left has not just doubled down, but really based their entire political movement on identity politics in the last 10 years. And I don't necessarily think that Republicans are on the wrong side when they're on the side of free speech. But as we can see in this conversation, they're not always.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Sarah Isger, the soapbox is yours.
Today, the Biden administration announced that it was going to extend the transportation mask mandate by another 30 days. The mask mandate was set to expire on March 18th. That means we have another month of wearing masks on airplanes. And look, set aside for adults, I don't enjoy wearing a mask on an airplane. It kind of hurts my ears on long flights, but it's a small price to pay to protect myself and protect others, to the extent, by the way, that those people are wearing N95s, which have been shown to be effective, whereas cloth masks, which are still allowed on planes to comply with the mask mandate, but have shown to be wildly ineffective. Even so, so be it. But I have a toddler, and if you've ever tried to put pants on a toddler or shoes on a toddler, good luck to you. You deserve a medal. Trying to put a mask on a two-year-old is impossible. These critters don't even speak English. And so to say that parents need to try to put masks on toddlers still for another month when they've been shown to be even more ineffective on children, cloth masks having zero effect because kids can't wear masks correctly, they don't wear them well, and they're constantly ripping them off their faces. I know parents who have been prevented from boarding flights because the toddler, quote unquote, isn't wearing their mask correctly, a cloth mask. This is silliness, it's anti-science, and it's just making parents' lives that much harder for another month.
All right, David Dayan, the floor is yours.
Well, this week is the two-year anniversary of the beginning of the pandemic in the U.S., and this week is also the end of the pandemic because we've returned to the time-honored American tradition of ignoring catastrophes until the moment they strike. Congress was all set to pass a budget bill with $15.6 billion for future COVID preparedness, new vaccines shipped abroad to prevent variants from emerging, new surveillance monitoring, new tests, new treatments. Republicans decided this had to be paid for. Democrats didn't like that idea, so Congress pulled the COVID money from the bill to avoid the fight. We're talking about $15 billion in a $1.5 trillion spending bill, literally 1% of the total, just to make sure that if and when the next Omicron shows up, we're at least somewhat ready. When we're not, and everyone's scrambling to find a rapid test and yelling about government incompetence, nobody will remember this week. Because forgetting who's responsible for foreseeable disasters is as American as the apple pie we won't be able to taste when we get COVID again.
And for my rant, when you have been coming home on your commute or out giving your dog a walk after work, there's something you probably notice. It's that you can probably now see your hand in front of your face because the days are getting longer. It's something we all look forward to and we all like. I don't know anybody who prefers darkness, which is why it is astonishing to me we still have not passed the Sunshine Protection Act, which would make daylight savings time permanent. That means on Sunday, when we all spring forward, we would never have to spring or fall again. We would just stay where we are. We already know the benefits of this. Research has shown that it decreases car accidents. It decreases crime when it's lighter outside. It certainly helps with sleep. As an insomniac, I can appreciate that. And it even helps with agriculture. So why are we not doing it? I think this is a no-brainer. So I think everyone should remind their elected officials that this is the right thing to do. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger, David Dayan, and Sammy Roth. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by John Meek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.